The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Let's go ahead and open up to Exodus in chapter 20. Exodus in chapter 20. We're going through the book of Exodus, and not long after Israel had crossed the Red Sea, they come to Mount Sinai, and there God made a covenant with this nation. And this covenant included a contract, and it included a commitment from Israel to live by the laws of that document. And so that agreement, we understand, included the Ten Commandments. And we had covered the first of these commandments several weeks ago before the holy day, the spring holiday season began. I'd given a sermon regarding the first commandment and went into great detail as to the application, the meaning, that is, of that first commandment. And so it's my desire to continue with this, and today I'd like to go through the second commandment. I would like to have a sermon on each of these commandments because there are many applications of them. Many times they're very clear cut and straightforward, but other times there are various tentacles, if you will, and excuse me for using that expression, but it reaches into various other aspects of our daily living. And so some people might understand these, some people might understand them in part, and possibly not too much at all. And so it would be nice to have these, and maybe we can offer them in our sermon library, at least having them on the website for people to review if necessary. And so the second commandment, therefore, is in Exodus 20, and beginning in verse 4, where God said, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or graven image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, this seems like it's a very clear-cut command, very straightforward, and there should be no question what was required of Israel when they were given this command, but also what is required of God's people down through the ages. We're not to make or we're not to possess idols. And so there's an obvious finger being pointed at here to those pagan deities, those pagan gods, and those have been numerous down through the ages. It's believed that there were about 115 Egyptian gods that were worshipped, and these would have been worshipped during the time that Israel was captive in Egypt. The Greeks had 370 approximately gods, and there were dozens of Roman gods, and many of these gods were borrowed from the Greeks. The Celts are known to have had about 374 gods, and the Hittites claimed to have 1,000 gods. You imagine 1,000? They must have had a god for everything. There's an ant god and a dirt god and a leaf god and everything. The Hindus of today, they have 309 deities in their religious practice. And this is just a few cultures that I mentioned. And there's just a few that we know of from archaeology and also from ancient writings that were passed down throughout history. And there's more actually even being discovered today as the archaeology movement goes forward. In fact, I had read a recent report that shows the Islamic State known as ISIS or ISIL has destroyed much of the 9th century BC palace of King Ashurnasirpal. And this was at the ancient Assyrian site in the city known as Nimrud. Now, this is an area that's believed to be associated with the ancient pagan king known as Nimrod and his empire, which came to be known as Babylon. Assyriologist Eckhart Fram told Yale News, he said that any major destruction at Nimrud or other ancient Assyrian cities in Iraq would be one of the worst cultural heritage disasters of all times. And the reason he says this is because Babylon is the earliest empire that we have archaeological evidence of. And there's quite a bit of it. And they were based in what is known as Iraq today. And so a lot of this is being destroyed because of the turmoil going on there. And so some people think that this is a tragedy, that they're losing a lot of the history of this place. And for this reason, it was a Biblical Archaeology Review. I'm on their emailing list. They compiled a series of articles written about these sites that are related to Babylon and also to Assyria. And I quote, they said this, they say, "We seek to make known what Nimrod was in antiquity, as well as what it means in modern times, to remember whatever may have been irreparably lost, and to inspire future excavation whenever that should become possible again." Let's go over to Romans 1. Romans 1. And so we understand that there are many people that believe there is much to be learned from ancient pagan cultures such as this. And one of the primary sources of understanding these ancient cultures is their idols, their gods, their religious practices, their shrines or altars or high places. And so Nimrod, we understand, was a major influence upon paganism around the world and throughout history. Numerous branches of the pagan religion sprang forth from this wicked dictator and his evil empire. In his article titled God's Funnel, it was Ray Stedman who wrote this about Nimrod, and this is talking about his mention in the book of Genesis. It says, "The account zooms in on an individual named Nimrod who was called a great hunter, but he was more than a hunter of wild animals. The Jewish Talmud helps us here, for it says that he was a hunter of the souls of men. And therefore, Nimrod introduced a perverted, degraded form of religion into the world. And it began at Babylon, it spread to Nineveh, and can be traced in history as it subsequently spread throughout the whole earth. And thus, in this man Nimrod, we have the seed of idolatry and false religion coming in again after the flood." Now we see that there was clearly idolatry after the flood when Nimrod established his society there, and he ambitiously set out to make a name for himself, to make a name for his people. And in fact, it's said that there are thousands of gods that can be traced back to the Tower of Babel when the language was confounded at that time. And the reason is because when the people dispersed and they went out and spread out all over the earth at that time after the language was confounded, they took their pagan gods, they took their pagan religion with them. But the names were changed. They were altered because they spoke a new language. And so as they went to different areas, they established new cultures. But they took those pagan idols from Babylon. And so idolatry since that time has corrupted entire nations for millennia. It's responsible for great evils throughout the world and many atrocities of humanity. And Paul wrote about such abominable forms of worship when he said this in Romans 1 in verse 22, he said, "These people, these idol worshippers, professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like a corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things." This is what they worshipped. In foolishness they did so. "And therefore God gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, and who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature or the creation rather than the Creator." Let's go over to Genesis 6. Genesis 6. So we see here people worshiping the creation instead of the Creator. And perhaps it's the pride of life that influences people to think that they know better to God than God. And they can decide for themselves how to worship and what to worship and what kind of standards or principles they will have in life. And this is foolish thinking, of course. As Isaiah had written in chapter 29, "For shall the thing say of him who made it, 'He did not make me'?" Sounds like some of the atheists or the evolutionists today. "God did not make us." "Or shall the thing formed say of him who formed it, 'Oh, he has no understanding. No, the Creator has no understanding. They don't know me. They don't know what I really need in life and what should be done.'" No, this is not the case at all. But who knows best? Who knows best for his creation? Of course, it would be the Creator knows what's best for his creation. Worshipping the creation is a way in which people break the second commandment. However, this is not the only kind of idol worship that God desired for his people and desires for his people to avoid. It's not simply the graven or carved images of birds or fish or some kind of dreamed up creature that might have a dozen breasts, as some of the Hindus worship. Creation is not just plants, animals, and celestial bodies. It also includes the exaltation of man, or even of a woman. And this is another form of worship connected to idolatry that must be avoided. And there is evidence, I think, of this type of worship that existed even before the flood. Consider this, if you will, Genesis 6, and beginning in verse 1, it's recorded, "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, all of whom they choose." And this sons of God is not referring to angels. This is talking about people that called themselves the people of God, called themselves sons of God. "They took wives, all of whom they choose, as many wives as they wanted. And the Eternal said, 'My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. And then it says, "There were giants," or "there became giants on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, and those were mighty men, where they were of old, men of renown." And so these giants, it's a reference to tyrants, or bullies even. And these mighty men that were born, they were warriors, even ruthless in their behavior. And they became men of renown, thinking very highly of themselves. They built a name for themselves through violence and through tyranny. And wouldn't it be like humankind to start setting themselves up, exalting themselves as a deity, as a god? I mean, we've seen this happen down through history. Even Pharaoh was worshipped as a god. And so it's likely that this was taking place before the flood, when evil became so bad that God decided, you know what, I have to destroy everything on earth except for the one faithful family that I can find. And so the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil. And he was sorry that he made man in the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And so I think this may be an indication of one of the most overlooked forms of idol worship. And that is those people who worship carved images, trees or fish, are obviously breaking the second commandment. But human beings who are elevating themselves, elevating their own thoughts above the thoughts of God, reasoning that they know what's best for them, even if it's contrary to the principles of God, this is a form of idolatry. It's a form of idolatry. People setting their own standards and choosing to follow their own way instead of God's way. Let's go over to Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55. For this reason, because it seems to be in human nature to try to do such things, to exalt the self, God wrote the following admonition, which directly relates, I think, to the second commandment. In Isaiah 55, and beginning in verse 7, God says to let the wicked forsake his way. That's not God's way. You can't say your way is above God's. No, that's idolatry. Forsake his way. Let the unrighteous man his thoughts. Forsake your own thoughts. If they are contrary to God's, they are not to be followed. And let him return to the Eternal, and God will have mercy on him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. And then he says this, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, as much as we might like to think they are. My thoughts are not your thoughts, says God, my ways, says the Eternal. For as heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And so we see then that self-exaltation is a sin. And in fact, self-exaltation is the original sin. Think about it. Isn't this what Lucifer did when he said, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will be over the angels. Yes, exalting himself, setting himself up as an idol, even before humanity was created. And so he chose to follow his own lead, and he persuaded others to follow his lead and to treat him like a god. And so idol worship, we understand, dates back to ancient times. And therefore, in our modern age, many people might think, well, that's a part of antiquated human history. You know, we really don't have to worry about today. But I think we're aware idolatry is alive and well in societies all around the world, even in America. There are many cultures that still pray, and they pay homage to sea creatures, or to animals, or to the trees, or to the wind, or to mountains, or to the sun. Yes, there are men and women today, even, that are worshipped even as a deity. In a magazine titled Christianity Today, it was reported that some fans of Elvis Presley were actually revering the rock star as a god. Pockets of semi-organized Elvis worship has taken a hold in a handful of states, they wrote. Worshippers will raise their hands, spell out Presley's name, work themselves into a fervor, and pray to the deceased musician. And a leader of this group was quoted as saying, "Followers believe Elvis watches over them. And if someone reports seeing Elvis, the priests at the Church of the Risen Elvis hold worship services where they have enshrined a lookalike doll of Elvis in an altar surrounded by candles and flowers." Now, this sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Of course it does to us. And even those people who profess to be Christian will say, well, that's just ludicrous. That's crazy. We would never do something so ridiculous such as this. However, a common practice of Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, Roman Catholics, and most Anglicans is to what? To consistently pray to those people they have labeled as saints, and to ask these saints to intercede with God on their behalf. And I'd read part of another article that's titled, "Know Your Patron Saints, a Prayer Guide." And it was written so, saying that there's a saint for every purpose under heaven. Sounds like a lot of gods that were worshipped by Egypt and Greeks, huh? It says to redirect your prayers to the right place. And they recommend praying to St. Jude for health-related issues, to St. Valentine, who is a patron saint of love and marriage, to St. Christopher, who is the patron saint of transportation, to St. Anthony, who is the saint of lost and found. So if you've lost your keys, your wallet, they even say, you can say a quick prayer, "Help me find my keys, St. Anthony." It's strange. They say to pray to St. Patrick for, well, I don't know, anything Irish or green, I suppose. I'm not really sure. And, of course, jolly old St. Nicholas for any prayer that's regarding children. But, you know, they have equal opportunity there in these religions. So they, not all saints are men, so they recommend praying to St. Rita, who's the saint, patron saint of parenthood, St. Elizabeth for our loss of parents, St. Genevieve, if you've been in a disaster or an accident, St. Teresa, who's the patron saint of headaches. That's interesting. And St. Margaret, who is a patron saint of businesswomen. Of course, there is the beloved St. Mary, who they call the Queen of Heaven, and many of them regard her even as above Christ because she was Christ's mother. And so we understand that praying to any of these dead people who are not even alive, This is a form of idolatry, isn't it? It is idolatry, and thousands of churches around the world will even make statues of these supposed saints, and they'll erect them in their churches, and millions of people will come by and they'll bow down to them and they'll pray to them and kiss the feet of these statues, and they think that they're communicating with them and then therefore with the higher supreme being. And isn't this a lot like pagan religion, isn't it? The pagan religion has gods of lower and higher degree. And so they just kind of mimicked what the pagans did, and they tried to put Christ's stance of approval on it, is what it seems. Let's go to Exodus 32. Exodus 32. And so we understand that there is idolatry around the world today that's outside of biblical religion, and there are forms of idolatry that has also crept into many churches, people that profess to have a religion based upon the Bible. And there's statues and crosses erected all around the world in various churches. There's paintings of Christ and even of God and of saints and Mary, and these are admired by millions of people. And perhaps the most common form of idolatry that you and I might see almost on a daily basis is the crucifix. The crucifix, otherwise known as the cross. This emblem was adopted by a heretical group of believers long ago, and if you've read our booklet, The Truth About the Cross, you understand that its origin is quite pagan, but that doesn't concern believers of today that hold crucifixes in high regard. People erect them in their sanctuaries, they put them in their homes, they print them in literature, they print them on Bibles, and they wear crucifixes around their necks and have them on their clothing even. And this has become an insignia of their belief, but it's actually a form of breaking the second commandment. It is a form of breaking the second commandment. It is an idol. We can't take anything that is related to a pagan religion and try to put God's stamp of approval on it and say that, well, we're worshiping God. We're worshiping Christ by using this thing. And this was a lesson that was recorded for us long ago. Moses had gone up into the mountain to talk with God, and the nation of Israel remained in the camps below. And after many days, the people became restless. In Exodus 32, beginning in verse 1, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, let us make gods that shall go up before us. For as this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' And Aaron said to them, 'Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me.' And so all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in the ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And so when Aaron saw it," he tried to save face a little bit here. He knew he had done wrong, but he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is a feast to the Eternal.' And then they rose early on the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." And so this serves as an example that we cannot pick and choose how we will worship God. As Jeremiah had realized and wrote, "I know the way of man, that it's not in himself to direct his own steps." And these people tried to make a golden calf, an idol, if you will, and they tried to proclaim a feast to God, to the true God, to the Eternal. They were trying to mix the religions here, what they had learned in Egypt, they took with them, and they were trying to use that here. But we can't do this. You see, if people were allowed to choose their own way of how they would worship God, we would create all kinds of bizarre and idolatrous rituals, which is exactly what humanity has done. That is what we have done down through the ages. Why, consider the most religious folk will drag an evergreen tree into their homes once a year, and they'll decorate it beautifully, adorn it with lights and beautiful ornaments, and then they'll place presents below its branches as if they're offering gifts, and they'll do it in the name of Christ. And then they'll paint eggs, and they'll establish a bunny as a symbol for Christ when that symbol clearly came from Ashtoreth or Yashtar, who is a fertility goddess. Let's go back to Exodus 20. And so we understand people have been known to worship all kinds of things, from birds and cattle to frogs and stars and whales and horses and even things like the wind and the rain people have worshipped. So does this mean that we can't have a statue of a horse or a painting of an eagle in our home? Does it mean we can't decorate our homes with anything, any sculpture of any kind? Well, the answer is realized, I think, when we consider the instructions for the second commandment here in Exodus 20. In Exodus 20 and verse 4, it says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." And then it says, "You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them." And what this tells us is that we are not to have idols or objects that we're going to use religiously, that we're going to use in our worship of God. And so we can have a ceramic statue or a glass statue of a dolphin. There's nothing wrong with that as long as we are not using it or bow down to it or using it in our worship of God. There's nothing wrong with having such decorative items, but this we can't go, okay, well, I'm going to have a statue of Baal in my house. I'm not going to worship it. It's just kind of a decoration. Now, we have to think reasonably here, okay? It's not okay to have statues of Buddha or pagan gods in our homes, saying, well, we don't worship them. And I don't think any of us would ever go there, but just for clarity's sake, we need to put that in the message. But another question may arise, and excuse my voice, I have allergies today and I can feel it starting to go out a little bit. A question may arise about the items in the temple, because there was an altar of incense in the temple, the table of showbread. There was, of course, the Ark of the Covenant. There was a brass laver outside, and there was the showbread itself. And these were items used in worship services for God. And so can those items be likened to idols? The answer should be obvious, but in case it's not, the answer is no, they're not, cannot be considered idols, because these were tools or instruments of the priests. And they were items that God actually commanded to be made to serve a specific purpose, and this purpose was outlined by God. Here is how you're going to use these items, and so they cannot be considered idols. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 12. So far, we have learned that are those things that can be considered idols and what is considered idolatry. And there are obvious forms of worship of the creation that is considered idol worship. And there's the pagan idols that are created, like Buddha or tikis or some of the Hindu gods and goddesses, and even crosses, we understand, or statues, even if it's supposed to be a statue of Christ or St. Paul or anything of that nature. These are forms of idolatry, and they do break the second commandment. But then there's the worship of the person, an individual, which we had mentioned briefly in the beginning here. Idolatry may take the form of someone who died, or even of someone who is still alive. And this leads us to discuss other ways of breaking the second commandment that might not be so obvious. If I asked people to raise their hand if they had bowed down to Ashtoreth this week, would anybody raise their hand? What about Baal? He's a very popular god. Anybody for Baal? No. None of us would raise our hand. We wouldn't put our hand up. But is it possible that we might be guilty of breaking the second commandment in another way? Another way that might not be so obvious. You see, the first commandment is to have no other gods before the true God. And it's no coincidence, therefore, that the second commandment has to do with things people might put in place of, before, or ahead of the true God. Consider that the world is filled with activities that people place ahead of obeying God. And so people will break the fourth commandment to keep the Sabbath holy. They'll break that every single week so that they can do their own pleasure. And they'll break the seventh commandment in lust. And they'll break the ninth commandment for personal gain or trying to get themselves out of a hard place. Or they'll break the second or the sixth commandment in murder or even just in a burning hatred towards somebody else. And people will idolize all kinds of things, not just statues, but people, musicians, statesmen, actors, professional sports stars. And they'll regard them as role models instead of Christ. An example of this form of idolatry, I think, came from in 1996. There was a banner erected at Lambeau Field. And this is when their quarterback, Brett Favre, it's regarding football, if you're not aware what Lambeau Field is, but their quarterback, Brett Favre, was named the most valuable player. And the banner read this. It said, "Our Favre, who art in Lambeau, hallowed be thine arm, Thy bowl will come, it will be won, in Phoenix as it is in Lambeau. Give us this Sunday our weekly win, and give us many touchdown passes. But do not let others pass against us. Lead us not into frustration, but deliver us to the valley of the sun. For thine is the MVP, the best of the NFC, and the glory of the Cheeseheads, now and forever. And so you can see this was created as kind of a joke, but I think it's very telling. It's not funny at all. It reflects how people feel about God. This was a model prayer that Christ gave, and they made fun of it. They made fun of it. To them, God's just a joke, and they just as soon apply how we are to worship him to anybody else. A sports star, let's apply it to him. We love Brett Favre. You know, the TV show that's very popular even still today, but I think it's kind of reached a plateau and then it kind of dropped a little bit. It's still very popular, is American Idol. And that title alone is very telling, isn't it? It's really telling of where people's minds are in this country today, because people generally desire idols instead of the true God. They would rather have an idol, because it becomes a matter of placing personal desires, our own desires, before what God's will is, what he desires of us. Most people will want to erect idols in their lives because idols do not set constraints on their behavior. They don't limit what I can do. I can do whatever I want. I'll just pick an idol that says it's okay. You know, I'll choose this person or that thing for a role model. And that I'll pick something that's like me, that wants to do what I want to do. And so they want to set up these idols in their lives instead of doing what God says, to tear them down, break them down, dash them to pieces, as he told Israel when they were going into the promised land. And God told them this in Deuteronomy 12 in verse 1, "These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the eternal God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains and on the high hills and under every green tree." And he's referring to places where they would set up altars and have their pagan worship services. "And you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire. And you shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Eternal your God with such things, but you shall seek the place where the Eternal your God chooses, and out of all your tribes, and put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go." And so these idols that God told his people to destroy when they went into the land, the altars, the places of worship, to tear down the high places, they were clearly visible most of the time. Most of the time, they were clearly visible. But there were some that were hidden, some that were in forests, some were that were very high in a very high mountain that was not easy to get to. And I think this reflects something in our lives. You see, there are idols in our midst that are very clear, very obvious, very blatant to see. We would never, you know, bow down to Buddha. We would never own a tiki or something of that nature. But then there are other idols in our lives, aren't there, that are harder to recognize, harder for us to see, and therefore harder to remove. And you know why? It's because they're our own. They're our own idols. We don't really want to see those. We want to kind of keep those tucked away. Let's not get too close in the examination process here. We want to hang on to our own idols that says that we're okay. You know, we might not wear crucifixes, we might not bow down to statues, or we might not idolize people or worship the creation, but what are some of the things that could be considered, idolatry in our lives? How about possessions? Stuff. You know, the things in our homes. How about our car? You know, how often do we let things get in our way of deciding how we're going to obey God? Because it might affect our stuff. Might affect things that we want. Do we find ourselves seeking to gain or to retain instead of considering how we can give, even give back to God? What about money? Money's a big one in our society. As secular folk, this is huge. But could it be something that also keeps us from obeying God? Because, you know, we want to keep as much of it as we can. We want to get as much of it as we can for ourselves. What about entertainment? Entertainment is a huge moneymaker in this society, and everybody, I think, partakes of entertainment in some form or another, and there's nothing wrong with it in and of itself. But could it be that there are certain movies, that there are certain music, or certain activities that are inappropriate, but we don't want to accept it? We kind of compromise and we let ourselves partake of those things because they're appealing. We enjoy them in some way. Do we put hobbies or personal pleasures before God? That is, doing those things before we consider doing some study or our prayer or fasting from time to time. Because in this way, some activities, some entertainment can be considered an idol to us because we obey our desire for them instead of doing what we should do, what God says we should do before our obedience to God. How about work? You know, there are some people that are like this, workaholics, if you will, some people that might find themselves working to get more and more, but then they're neglecting time that should be spent with their family or time that should be spent with God. Of course, you can take the other direction. There might be some people that avoid work and kind of set themselves up as an idol because I don't want to be uncomfortable. Well, the reason people create idols is because they are things that we can control. We set them up. There are things that we desire, that we want, or some things that we want to avoid. And so an idol, therefore, it can't talk back. When we create an idol in our mind, it can't talk back to us and say, no, you shouldn't be doing that. No, because we've set it up as something that we adore, that we admire. As Jeremiah wrote about physical idols, he said, they are upright, like a palm tree. They cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. You know, the idol is really no thing. It's just, that's where it is. It's a thing. It's not an individual. It's not a god. It's not a deity. And it can't do anything in and of itself. It's something that we create. And we make it what we want it to be. We can control our personal idols and we can set limits on how they affect our lives. And we like that. Human nature likes that because it makes us the God. It puts us in charge of our lives. And this can be more comforting to us than having a supreme being dictate our behavior and saying, nope, you got to stay away from that. So people tend to erect idols in their lives, and then some will do this, and I think it was pointed out in the example of Israel and the golden calf. They'll erect an idol in their life, and then they'll proclaim a feast to the eternal. Sadly, I think many of us might be more like the people of ancient Israel than we want to believe. We are ancient Israel in many ways, and they are an example for us. And they are an example because we're kind of like them in some way. Some ways more than others. Let's go to 2 Kings in chapter 18. And so think about it. Think about it this week. What kind of idols might we have in our lives? Are there things that keep us from entirely obeying God? And if there are, they are forms of idolatry, and it doesn't have to be a statue of Baal. It can be any object. It can be any activity that we lean toward before or instead of obeying God. A number of years after Israel came into the Promised Land, there were many judges and kings that ruled over the people, governed them, if you will. And some of these were bad, and they allowed idolatry in places, high places of worship to be built, and others were good, and they would not allow such activity among the people of Israel, and they would have them torn down. And though these good kings and judges were relatively few, they stand, I think, as an example for us. Now consider, if you will, King Hezekiah, a good king, in 2 Kings in chapter 18, and beginning in verse 1, now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, the king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. And he was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his father, David, had done. And he removed the high places and broke the sacred pillars and cut down the wooden image and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it Nehushtan. And so this was an item that God said to be made, but they started treating it like an idol, started burning incense to it, worshiping this object. And so he broke it down because it was no thing. It was just brass. It wasn't a real living being. It wasn't a deity at all. And so this man, Hezekiah, in verse 5, he trusted in the eternal God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor who were before him. And for he held a fast to the eternal, and he did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments which the eternal had commanded Moses. And the eternal was with him, and he prospered wherever he went, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. So we see that Hezekiah was faithful in obeying the commandments of God, and he destroyed the idols, and he tore down the high places of pagan worship, and he restored God's faith among many people in Judah. And though his life was not entirely a bed of roses, he did have his trials from time to time. God considered his works, and God delivered him from evil. And he went down in the history books as a good man, a good king, because he did what was right in the sight of God in tearing down the idols in the high places. And so I ask us to consider his example. You know, are we looking for those high places in our lives? Are we trying to remove the idols in our mind? Are we striving to be fully committed to God, to keep his commandments in every way possible? Where do we stand? Where do we stand? What side of the fence are we on? Or could it be that we're kind of sitting on the fence, having an idol in one hand and the Bible in the other, kind of weighing what is the best option for us? Well, I think we know what the best option is. Consider another example. Just before Elijah had confronted the prophets of Baal, and these were prophets that had risen up among the people of Israel, Elijah came before a multitude of people on Mount Carmel, and he said this. He said, "How long will you falter between two opinions?" Speaking to the people. "If the Eternal is God, then follow him. But if Baal is God, if you think Baal is God, well, then follow him." In other words, do we believe in God or not? If we do believe in God and we do believe he's the right God, follow him. Don't be on the fence. Don't be trying to decide, well, is it Baal or is it God? I don't really know. Make up your mind. Go one way or the other, as he said. And if we don't believe in the true God, well, then follow the idols. You know, don't be lukewarm. And I think this has gone over many times throughout sermons, but Revelation 3, Christ says that this tepid, lukewarm, half-hearted attitude, it's repulsive to him. He wants nothing to do with it. He wants us to go one way or the other. And of course, we know which way he wants us to go. The right way, to obey God. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 10. Now, if we are struggling with a sin that has become an idol to us, don't be discouraged. Don't be discouraged by this. Remember that we can't fight our battles alone. Yes, we can do a lot on our own, and we have to make a choice. We have to make a decision. Which way are we going to go? But then we come to God, and we ask him to help us to remove these high places in our mind. Now, consider what Paul wrote in this regard in 2 Corinthians 10, and beginning in verse 4. Let's pick it up in verse 3. "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments," or our inner reasoning is what that means, "and casting down every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." And so we can fight these pulls of human nature. We can fight them, but the weapons to win this battle are not entirely temporal. We can't do it on our own. There are weapons that are found with God. And that's why God sent the Comforter, the Holy Spirit, a helper, if you will, to help us to overcome. And God will help us. But this doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It's not going to be a cakewalk. But you know what? Nothing worthwhile in life ever is. Anything that's worth something, that is truly of value, people have to work for. People have to work at it. But we can do it. We can do this with God. As Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And so with God's help, we can stop that inner reasoning that is trying to tell us to stray from God, and we can cast down everything that tries to exalt itself above God's moral standards. And we can be obedient to God. We can do this. So God doesn't give us false hope. We can do it. So don't get discouraged. It is entirely possible. Let's go back to Exodus 20. Exodus 20, and we're going to end over there. A little bit short today. Removing the inner idols will be difficult. It will be trying. It's going to be testing, if you will. It's going to test our strength. It will challenge our will. It's going to be hard at times. Many will not have the willpower to follow through, to completely follow through. And for this reason, God said something very interesting, I think, in the second commandment, where he said this, Exodus 32, let's go. Exodus 20. He said, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is heaven and above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those that hate me, but showing mercy to the thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, there's a couple things I want to point out here. So you see, some believe that jealousy is like a hostile form of coveting, but that's not what God's being said. God's not saying, I covet greatly. What he's saying is that he is intolerant of unfaithfulness. God is not hospitable to idols. That's what he's saying here. But think about this for a moment. Notice the last words of this command. It says, God will punish those who create or retain idols unto the third and fourth generations. But then it says, he will show mercy to thousands that love him and who show their love by keeping his commandments. Well, I have a question. Why thousands? Why only thousands? I mean, out of the millions of people that God has worked with down through the time, why does God say that he will show mercy to thousands? Is this just a figure of speech, just saying, well, it's a relative few? Or could it be that God knew that there would only be thousands who would become faithful, true and faithful servants, true commandment keepers? Could this be pointing to the 144,000, even, that are going to be chosen? And then I have a question for us to ask ourselves. Will we be one of those thousands that will have mercy shown to us? Malachi in chapter 3 talks about a book of remembrance that will be divinely written regarding the faithful people of God, even people at the end of the age. And wouldn't it be nice to be included among those people, to have our name put in the book of remembrance, to have our works, have the bad parts edited out, of course, hopefully, but to have our works, our character that we had built, recorded in God's book of remembrance. Understand that it's entirely possible. We can do this. We can be like the champions of faith that removed the high places. And so, let's make sure we keep God's second commandment, and let's remove every idol from our lives.